You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 55 AM. And you are joined today by Jacob Andruffer, who is going to be one of your co-presenters today. And I'm very happy to be joined by...
It's Mary Merkinich.
Quite a packed program today. But maybe before we start, I'll pass it on to Mary to do the acknowledgement of country.
3CR and Green Left acknowledge that this show is broadcasted on the Wurundjeri land of the Kulin Nation. This is stolen land because sovereignty was never ceded. The land was taken by force through colonial violence and displacement and the attempted genocide of the First Peoples. The struggle for First Nations sovereignty is deeply connected with the struggle against racism and capitalism. And as socialists, we pledge to actively fight for decolonisation. We proudly stand with First Nations people for justice, sovereignty and land rights.
Okay, so just to announce what we have coming up in the program, we're going to be speaking to Green Left journalist and Socialist Alliance member Ben Radford about the recent Colombian elections. Now, the Colombian elections actually happened around the end of last month. We're going to be having a bit of a discussion about broader politics, especially given that a far-right kind of candidate won by a slim margin against a left-wing candidate. So we're going to kind of unpack what's happening there. The second thing is we are going to be interviewing Jai Batham, who's part of Knox for Palestine, and he is part of organising an action against Rosebank Engineering that's going to be taking place in Bayswater this Saturday. And then at 8:10 a.m. we're going to be speaking to Deepak Joshi, who's actually been a guest on our program before, but we're going to be speaking to him a bit about Modi's recent visit to Australia, which happened last week, and we want to kind of unpack some of the things that had kind of happened there, including some of the protests that happened against Modi, but also what are some of the political implications of Modi's visit in terms of fostering the Australia-India relationship. And in fact, there was one announcement that Australia is going to be exporting uranium to India. And there's also even talks of further military discussions. So yeah, we'll be having a discussion with Deepak to get a bit of a report on all those elements and more. And maybe to start off, I wanted to go a bit into the sort of headline news stories. So probably one of the main stories I want to talk about today was, you know, this whole Royal Commission into anti-Semitism that has been happening for like the past several months. Now, I think that this whole commission has been a bit of a kind of sham in a lot of ways. And probably one of the more refreshing elements, though, was the fact that Yasmin Johnson, a Jewish student, socialist, and also one of the national coordinators of Students for Palestine, was able to give testimony at the Royal Commission. And essentially, Yasmin was able to, you know, essentially put the arguments that any Palestine solidarity activist would support, drawing on the fact that she comes from a Jewish background. She has lived experience of having family members who survived the Holocaust, you know, essentially saying that the legacy of historical injustices perpetrated against Jews, the marks of which have been left on my family, has strengthened my resolve to oppose genocide wherever it takes place. And so Yasmin in particular very much countered these sort of arguments that are being pushed by the Royal Commission that standing in solidarity with Gaza is inherently anti-Semitic, refusing this notion that saying from the river to the sea is some call for the expulsion or genocide of Jewish people, very much made all these very clear arguments. And I think it was very refreshing that Yasmin was able to give testimony at the Royal Commission. And I think it would have definitely stirred things up because really the whole Royal Commission has been a bit of a sham, especially in terms of, you know, the framework in which it's collecting information. information. I mean, one of the bit of evidence that was given at the Royal Commission was a Zionist sort of saying that, oh, you know, it's so outrageous that I have friends of mine that don't want to talk to me because I identify as a Zionist. And then other ridiculous testimony like, you know, I can't believe the university took so long to take action against the Gaza solidarity encampments that happened 2 years ago. Like, you know, this is just, I think, absurd in a lot of ways.
Well, it's absurd, but it's also just shows you their worldview. But in addition, Alice Schwarzer from the Jewish Council of...
You mean Sarah?
Oh, Sarah. Sorry. Yeah. Yes, I don't know. Oh, I'm thinking of someone else. Yes, where she spoke as well. And she's also Jewish and her organisation is an anti-Zionist organisation. So there were a few people that were able to be heard, but of course, overwhelmingly, they permitted Zionists to take the stage at this commission.
And I think also one issue that has to be raised in this context is that the reality is, when you look at the evidence and the lived experience of what's happening, is Islamophobia, as reported in this article published by Pip Hinman in Green Left titled Islamophobia is a Major Racist Problem Today, Islamophobia is a bigger problem than anti-Semitism, but government agencies and the mainstream media would have you think the opposite. And this is based on the fact that the Islamophobia Register Australia reported a huge 740% spike in
attacks.
Even the Conservative Centre for Independent Studies said that while Israel's standing is at a low ebb, the public warmth towards Jewish Australians is generally encouraging. It said while there was a perception of increasing anti-Semitism, especially among older Australians, in terms of attitude alone, Australia does not have a particular problem with anti-Semitism. But this same study also found that Australians are more likely to be negative towards Muslims. About 30% have negative feelings towards Muslims, while only 12% have negative feelings towards Jews. 10% have extremely negative view of Muslims compared to just 3% towards Jews. And I think the fact that there was this brutal bashing of a Muslim father of three in late June and has prompted the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils to again call on the federal government and media organisations to commit to a serious national response to Islamophobia.
Well, and there's attacks that are just ignored by the authorities. Like there was one incident where a group of people were wearing Palestinian keffiyehs, that's the scarf. They reported the attack. They provided evidence. Members of Parliament raised questions about the case. The offender even pleaded guilty. And yet that racist nature of that attack wasn't really recognised. And there's many incidents which go unreported because people feel that nothing's going to happen. I was with a group of older women when we attended a pro-Palestinian rally. This goes back a few months. And it was when there were works on the road or something. We had to take a bus. Anyway, we get off the bus and we walked up to the metro workers to ask for directions. And one of the people looked at us and said, "You disgust me. What about all the babies being killed in Israel?" And yeah, he was very abusive. And when we asked for help, he just turned away. We reported that and nothing was ever done. I kept emailing and nothing was ever done. So, you know, that's not Islamophobia, but it just shows that when people are being attacked for supporting the Palestinians, even then they get attacked and nothing happens.
Yeah. And what's quite clear is that in the context of this Royal Commission into anti-Semitism, it's clearly been engineered in a way where they're only listening to some voices while excluding others. So, you know, on one hand, while it's good that Yasmin and Sarah Schwartz were able to give testimony, at the other hand, the Royal Commission has deliberately excluded the Australian Palestine Advocacy Network and many anti-Zionist Jewish groups. So in a sense, this is almost like a kangaroo court in a lot of ways. Mm. And I also think that one thing it says is that how the capitalist state builds consensus and how it kind of frames things in a particular way that is more, you know, in a sense, supports the interests of the ruling class in power. So in a sense, it creates this hysteria, this framework in which you understand things and ultimately legitimizes those viewpoints. So, for example, Julian Siegel basically said things along the lines of, well, you can't trust the death tolls that come from Gaza because they've been grossly exaggerated because, you know, they all come from the Hamas-controlled areas of Gaza. Well, I mean, ultimately, Hamas is the democratically elected government of Gaza. So, of course, that would mean they run the hospitals and that, of course, that means the statistics will come from them. Like, this is just frankly ridiculous. But also, how could you look at the images that are coming out of Gaza and then come with this takeaway that the numbers are being grossly inflated?
Yeah, it's disgusting.
Yeah, I think it's disgusting in a lot of ways. But I think all the solidarity to those who are putting forward the alternative perspective, and I also think the bigger picture as well, is there has been this increased climate of attempting to repress and criminalise pro-Palestine activism. And I think part of this Royal Commission is about legitimising that...
Criminalisation.
And also the targeting of pro-Palestine activists and the intimidation of them. So I think, yeah, it's very important. But I know, Mary, you wanted to have a story to share from your home country in Germany, especially in terms of the opposition to the far right.
Well, it's actually not my home country. I was born in Australia.
Yeah.
But my parents were migrants from Germany. So talking about racism, anti-Semitism and so forth, the German equivalent of One Nation, but they're much better organised, is the AfD, or Alternative für Deutschland, Alternative for Germany. They recently had their party conference in Erfurt on July 4 to 5, where they re-elected their two leaders, Alice Weidel and Tino Kupala, and they also, you know, discuss strategy, and they're polling really well, again, a bit like One Nation, and it looks like they may be able to win one of the states in the eastern part of Germany, which formerly was East Germany, but of course that no longer exists. So it was interesting that, according to Reuters, as their delegates arrived to this conference, they had a song called Send Them Back playing to greet delegates, and they were selling cards which had slogans such as, you will be deported. The other thing that raised anger amongst people was that the date that the AfD chose for its conference was July the 4th. On July the 4th in 1926, during the second Nazi Party conference in Weimar, which is very close to Erfurt, Adolf Hitler successfully rallied his fragmented party, and it was there that they founded their youth group. So the conference was important in reorganization and centralizing the Nazi movement. And because of that date's significance, German historians and politicians have accused the AfD of sending a coded message to voters who have far-right views. At the same time, they're parading around to the general public that they're innocent of any ties to Nazis. But to meet this conference, there were reports of at least 30,000 people who were protesting the AfD's policies. They arrived from several directions for the rallies, for sit-ins, and they jammed roads. Some of the protesters glued themselves to tram tracks to cause disruption to any of the delegates coming. And it's reported that the protesters came from different age groups. There were some trade unionists and all sorts of different political orientations, and they all said that they were scared of the AfD coming to power and they saw it as their duty to act. There were a couple of groups that had organised this. One was called the Resistance Alliance, and another one was, which was attended by the Federal Environment Minister Carsten Schneider and Thuringer's Interior Minister. Thuringer is the state in which Erfurt is part of. Georg Mayer, he's the Interior Minister. They attended the second group, and it was organised by a group calling themselves Standing Together Alliance, and another group called Grandmas Against the Right waved homemade signs. There were calls for the AfD to be banned because they accused the AfD of promoting racist and anti-Muslim policies, and they're also angry that a lot of the AfD politicians continuously downplay Nazi crimes. So, yeah, that's what happened in early July in Germany.
Yeah. Well, that's positive news. And I think it's good that we're seeing resistance to the far right in Germany. And I think there's obviously lessons that we can draw from while being in Australia, because, you know, we are dealing with a growing kind of support for One Nation and so on, which seeks to kind of push politics much further to the right.
And it's also interesting that the German government that's in power at the moment, which is a coalition of right-wing conservative Christian groups and the Social Democrats, that their response is to try and introduce conservative policies such as cutting back the welfare system and workers' rights. Yeah, I've forgotten their work. There's quite a few other things. Well, and the AfD is rising popularity. Again, this is similar to what's happening here because of rising rents, rising living costs, and the attacks, of course, on the welfare system that people are feeling. So very similar to here. And the other thing that I found that was reminiscent of the Australian government's actions and words is that the German government wants to implement the changes next month, so swiftly. And as Merz, who is the Chancellor, said failing is not an option when he refers to trying to implement these neoliberal policies. And one of the leaders of the Conservative Christian Democrats also said that they had to get in the weeds of the wording, be united to implement these policies. So it's just reminiscent of Albanese and the others saying that, you know, their policies, such as cutbacks to the NDIS, have to be implemented quickly, and other cutbacks that they're doing. So, yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to have our first interview with Ben Radford soon, but we might delay it a bit. Maybe we'll play a quick song. So this is something that Mary picked out, Flintholm 5 by Norland Wind. Do you have any comments you want to sort of add?
Well, I picked it because my husband, who is Iranian, has a nephew who is a percussionist, and he played, there's five in this group, obviously, because they're called the Flintoff Five, and his name is Afra Muzawazadi, and I think it's a lovely piece.
All right. Hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio. You are listening to Green Left Radio, and we're just listening to Flintholm 5 by Norland Wing. So we're now happy to be joined by our first live interview for this program. So we're joined by Ben Radford, who is a member of Social Science and also a writer for Green Left. Ben spent a whole trip abroad, spending a lot of time in Latin America, and he also writes quite a lot on Latin American politics for Green Left. And so we have him on to have a bit of a discussion about the recent Colombian election that happened recently, where the left-wing kind of candidate lost by a slim margin to a far-right presidential candidate. So, yeah, good morning, Ben.
Morning, Jacob. Good morning, everyone.
Yeah, good morning, Ben. It's Mary.
So the recent Colombian presidential election on June 21st involved a far-right presidential candidate winning against a leftist candidate by a slim margin. Maybe to orientate our listeners, can you tell us a bit about the political background and political issues in Colombia that have led to this result?
So, yeah, just on the election itself, as you mentioned, it was a very tight runoff. It was actually the tightest presidential elections in the history of the country. And I guess a bit of the background to that is that in Colombia, we just had the end of 4 years of left-wing government under Gustavo Petro, which is actually widely recognised as the country's first left-wing government. And so there were a lot of gains made in areas like healthcare and workers' rights, which maybe I'll talk a little bit more about later. And also was significant in the sense that it opened a sort of open space for social movements to, I guess, consolidate. But obviously, you know, like with any left-wing government coming to power in the region, obviously operated within severe constraints. And so some of them were, you know, with things like not having a majority in Congress. So a lot of the quite significant reforms were either watered down or blocked, especially some of the government's tax reforms, which was basically aimed at taxing higher earners and taxing some of the profits from big business, which obviously that was blocked. And so obviously that meant that in terms of funding social spending and in terms of redistributive policies, that was very limited by this sort of hostile Congress. And then obviously, you know, externally as well, you know, you look at Colombia's position in the global economy and the regional economy. It's an export-based economy, which, you know, is subject to the fluctuations of the market. Pretty much all the resources are in the hands of private companies as well. So obviously that's a big limitation on what you can achieve with just achieving, you know, an electoral victory and being the head of government. And so that meant that obviously there was still significant reforms for working-class Colombians, but at the same time, there was also a sense in the lead-up to the election that the government had not been able to implement a lot of the promised reforms. You know, it's not to say that Petro wasn't, well, he's still quite a very popular leader. He was actually barred from running as a candidate because you're only allowed to run for one term as president. So Ivan Cepeda, who was in this presidential elections, he was seen as Petro's successor. They're both from the same party, which is called the Historic Pact. But as you mentioned before, he narrowly lost. And I guess also in terms of the wider context, you know, we're seeing a lot of, I guess, a far-right resurgence in the region, well, and globally, particularly in Latin America. You know, you look at Chile, basically just had a far-right win there. And, you know, obviously with the support of the US, particularly under Donald Trump, sort of seeking to reaffirm US imperialism in the region. So, yeah, I guess that's some of the background leading up to the election itself.
Ben, tell us more about De La Esparella and what the political right in Colombia represents.
Yeah, so De La Esparella is sort of a pretty classic far-right figure. He sort of modelled himself a lot on for example, Javier Milei, who's the far-right president in Argentina at the moment, also on Bukele, who's the president of El Salvador. And he's one of these ones that sort of positions himself as an outsider, as an anti-establishment figure. But basically, he, in a similar way to Pauline Hanson, I guess, obviously there's not a lot of similarities, but there's some similarities in the way that Pauline Hanson presents herself as this anti-establishment, you know, standing up for workers and stuff like that, but she's essentially part of, you know, represents this ruling elite. And it's similar with Del Esprit. I mean, he made his whole career was basically as a lawyer, defending, like, corporate criminals, defending members of the paramilitaries who are responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths over decades in Colombia. He himself, basically a real estate mogul, has properties in the US, you know, is a millionaire. And so he's definitely representative of this rich business class. You know, he himself has been investigated for money laundering, but basically because of his connections within state institutions like the Attorney General's office, you know, he was never convicted for this. And he's all still had close ties with, for example, one of the biggest far-right paramilitary and drug trafficking groups in Colombia, and even founded an organization to basically support this paramilitary group, like organizing university forums and campaigning against them being prosecuted. And so in terms of his campaign, he basically is advocated for this heavy militaristic violent approach to security in the country, which obviously involves increasing spending and granting powers to the police and the military. You know, he's an outspoken supporter of Netanyahu and Israel, and has basically said that Colombia should use the same tactics that Israel uses against Palestinians, but in Colombia. So he's also pledged to reverse a lot of Petro's policies towards Israel, which was, you know, to cut ties and also to end coal exports there. So obviously a pretty unsavory character, and has sort of managed to, without putting any forward any policies really, but just to sort of stoke, exploit fear, you know, and this very real threat of violence that hangs over the country, to basically put forward these easy fixes, or seen as quick fixes, to what are quite structural issues that he himself has actually contributed to worsening. And so if we look at him compared to Cepeda, who was the leftist candidate who narrowly lost, he, as I mentioned, was sort of seen as the successor to Petro. So a lot of his policies were essentially a continuation of Petro's policies, including, I think I may we'll talk about, a little bit about it later, but including things like total peace, which is basically under Petro, and Cepeda was actually an architect of the policy as well, basically seeking dialogue with different remaining guerrilla groups in the country and other sort of armed groups that are still active, seeking dialogue with them to commit to this ongoing peace, which represented a break from just like the military operations of the past.
All right. So the next question is, one of the important things that forms a bit of a background to politics in Colombia has been this ongoing guerrilla war between the government of Colombia and far-left kind of Maoist sort of groups like the National Liberation Army. And both sides of politics in Colombia have often had their own sort of positions, with obviously the far-right often using the fact that they're going to take a hard line against these guerrilla fighters being the kind of main thing that wins them support, whereas the left has favoured an approach of negotiation, trying to actually negotiating to end the conflict. How has this backdrop impacted on the political landscape in Colombia, especially in terms of these recent elections?
Yeah, as I mentioned, it's this very real violence and threat of violence that hangs over Colombian society, and particularly around elections, it's heightened. And while, you know, the ELN and this group that was FARC, which essentially was deactivated, laid down its arms, but there was all these splinter groups that are still active. They basically committed to a 6-month ceasefire a little bit before in the run-up to the election. But then before that, it's sort of been, yeah, as you mentioned, this sort of difficult, fraught process between the government, which, as I mentioned, has tried to enact this policy of what they call total peace, which is dialogue with these different groups, and a process of reintegration of basically saying, yeah, if you lay down your arms and commit to peace, then you can be integrated back into society, which, you know, the right wing is totally opposed to. They basically essentially exploit this very real fear to try and discredit this idea that, you know, people can be reintegrated, that there can be peace. What they put forward is, you know, basically this iron fist approach of, well, we just need to essentially lock up or kill all of the armed forces and armed guerrillas, which has basically been the approach over decades, which, as we've seen in Colombia, does not work and actually increased violence, resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, especially in rural areas, you know, as well as torturing and disappearances and a whole range of other human rights abuses. But it's still a very real fear, and it's still a very big issue in Colombian society that the right wing and the far right is definitely trying to exploit. And I guess a very real fear with Dela Espriella, who's openly said that, you know, we need to have this militaristic US-backed approach, is a real fear that there'll be a return to the same approach over the past decades, which, as I mentioned, results in widespread violence, which, you know, should be mentioned, was totally backed by the US, sort of under the guise of putting down these guerrilla uprisings and combating drug trafficking. But as we know, it was actually a vehicle for securing US interest in the region, whether it be for agribusiness or mining or whatever else. So, yeah, that's sort of the backdrop of these negotiations. Oh, I actually should mention, with this total peace policy, a lot of it was actually informed by the findings of the Colombian Truth Commission, which was essentially set up after this, you know, long period of violence to basically bring together testimonies and interviews with a lot of the victims and the paramilitaries and military and guerrillas, which basically had this final report which urged an end to this militarized approach over the past decades to drug policy and to security, which in every case actually exacerbated drug trafficking and exacerbated violence. So that's the, you know, still an ongoing issue in Colombia.
Ben, you mentioned earlier about the advances that had been made under the left-wing Gustavo Petro. Can you just go into a bit of detail about how this right-wing guy, how that threatens these gains made by Petro?
So, yeah, I guess just to talk about some of the gains, there's actually a really good report by the Center for Economic and Policy Research that essentially looks over the last 4 years and details a lot of them in quite a bit of detail. But I guess in terms of broad brush, which I mentioned before, basically poverty reduction is a big aim of the Petro government, and so increased a lot of spending on sort of access to healthcare and improving housing conditions, which actually resulted in poverty reducing by quite a significant percentage. For example, there's this indicator called multidimensional poverty, which considers things like education and housing conditions, access to healthcare. That reduced about 23% since 2022 when Petro came to power. As I mentioned before, he was able to enact, sort of by decree essentially, because a lot of them wouldn't pass through Congress, things like increases to the minimum wage, basically double the minimum wage, and other things in terms of healthcare and pensions, basically put through. I guess to provide a bit of context, Colombia has probably one of the most privatized in terms of institutionally. Is very privatized. So the healthcare system, the pension system, they're all totally privatized. So basically one of the aims of the Petro government was to undo some of these. So with the pension reform, basically he tried to reintroduce a sort of public pillar and provide sort of guarantees for some of the poorest workers where, you know, your contributions are sort of matched by the government. One of the other probably most significant gains was redistributing land. So basically over, you know, decades of violence where many, you know, millions of people were internally displaced in Colombia. Colombia actually has one of the highest internally displaced populations in the world. And this is a sort of a result of this violence that basically just would raise entire villages and displace entire communities. That basically one of the policies of the Petro government was to basically provide land titles and sort of formalize and then redistribute millions of hectares of land to these indigenous communities, to these sort of poor agricultural communities, as well as Afro-Colombian communities and victims of this armed conflict, to basically redistribute some of this land. And, you know, it's obviously stopped short of being like a full-on agricultural land reform, but was obviously still a significant step, a significant gain. Another one, which is definitely worth mentioning, is the government's ban on new oil and mining projects in the Amazon region, which is pretty significant when it's basically nearly half of the country's land, or, you know, land mass is the Amazon. And this is part of pushing for a transition away from these fossil fuel projects, which, you know, if we're looking now at the new incoming government, this far-right guy has sort of openly said that he supports, you know, oil and gas and mining everywhere, has totally sort of rejected this policy of the energy transition, which is being brought forward by the current government and been brought forward by a lot of the social movements over years. So So, yeah, I mean, he's basically going to work to undo a lot of these gains. But I think, you know, it's worth reinforcing the importance of the social movements and the grassroots movements in Colombia, which will, of course, resist a lot of these. And we saw as recently as 2021, there was huge uprisings against the neoliberal government at the time that was basically trying to bring in these healthcare and tax reforms, which essentially there was a national strike, there was national uprisings all across the country, which pretty much brought down the government and was the force that provided the opening, really, in a lot of ways, was basically decisive in sweeping Petro to power. You know, he then got elected in 2022, essentially off the back of this anti-neoliberal discontent that was really significant in, you know, also successfully blocking these anti-worker and anti-people reforms. So, you know, obviously we're probably facing a period of far-right resurgence and imposition or re-imposition of these really, you know, neoliberal policies, but I would say there's going to be very significant resistance to these. So, yeah, maybe I'll end on that note.
Well, that's good if there's resistance.
So that's a good note to end on, Ben. Thank you very much for being on 3CR. And, yeah, just highly encourage our listeners to look up Ben Radford's articles on Green Left, where he does a lot of analysis on politics in Latin America and has been covering a lot of the developments. So thanks again, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
The media in this country, we as Indigenous people know, have censored our right of telling the truth, and the truth is what this country is most fearful of, in particular Indigenous truths. Until history is told by the vanquished lens, which is our people telling our story our way, and have the right to be able to incorporate that into a system of learning, well, people are always going to be denied that truth by deceit and lies. When you look at the type of psychological warfare and spiritual warfare that Aboriginal people are caught in, it's not just in the sense of military when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it's in terms of the media and the industry of media as a warfare against our people, and so is religion, I believe, in the Western sense. They're all weapons of mass destruction against our people.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Okay, you're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM, and I'll pass on to Mary to introduce our next guest.
Just before I do that, I want to mention just a couple of things. One is Ben's interview reminded me of a film I saw recently called Blue Trail, which is about or has beautiful pictures of the Amazon, and it's a story based in Brazil. So that's a very interesting movie. I won't say more about it. I also want to acknowledge that just recently, four women have been killed in domestic violence. So that's another indicator that we're not doing enough around violence against women. Okay, so Jai Batham is an organizer with Knox for Palestine. He's a passionate advocate for social and ecological justice. He's an educator and a musician. He is currently conducting doctoral research on Australian climate politics and social theory at Swinburne University, and he has lived most of his life in and around the Dandenong Ranges. Good morning, Jai.
Morning, Mary. Morning, Jacob. Thanks for having me.
Yep, you're very welcome. So you are involved in planning a community rally at the Rosebank Engineering Factory in Bayswater. Who or what is Rosebank Engineering, and why are you protesting outside that factory?
Yeah, so Rosebank Engineering, they're a precision engineering and aircraft component manufacturer in Bayswater, which is in the outer eastern suburbs of Melbourne. It's quite a big complex that they have out here. They were acquired by an organisation called ASDAM back in 2022, and that stands for Australian Sovereign Defence and Advanced Manufacturing Group. And these guys, they 100% own Rosebank, but they also own a number of other advanced manufacturing companies in Australia, particularly based in Melbourne. And these include Morand, TAE Aerospace, Levitt Engineering, Quickstep and Oldham Engineering. And this entire group, but specifically Rosebank, are really integral to the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program, which I'll talk a bit more about later. But basically, what they do here at this factory in Rosebank is provide around 150 parts to the F-35 fighter jet. And this is the fighter jet that Israel has been relying on to carry out its genocidal bombardments in Gaza and in Lebanon and the broader region. On top of that, they provide the sole supplier of this part called the Uplock Actuator System. This is the system that opens and closes the weapon bomb bay doors to allow the jet to drop its payload within seconds and maintain its stealth capabilities. So they're the only company in the world that provides this specific part for the F-35 jet. So without Rosebank Engineering, these jets couldn't fly, they couldn't drop their payloads. And they're also really integral for repairing and maintaining the jet's power systems and the thermal management systems, as well as their landing gear. So we're out there protesting on Saturday because, you know, the IDF rely on this F-35 to carry out its genocide. This jet's basically become synonymous with the genocide that's been happening in Gaza. And so locals are understandably, you know, astounded that there's business activities happening in their area that's contributing to this genocide. And so that's why we're standing up against it.
And can you tell us a bit about the details of the protests this Saturday, especially in terms of the different groups that are involved that have endorsed the protest?
Yeah, for sure. So it's been organised by a broad coalition of Eastern Suburbs Palestine advocacy groups. So we've got, obviously, my organisation, Knox for Palestine, which is the area that Bayswater falls within, is Knox. We've got Dandenong Palestine Action Group as well, Whitehorse Palestine, Menzies for Palestine as well. So a whole bunch of Eastern groups, Yarra Rangers for Palestine, are also endorsing it. We've all come together to collaborate on organising this over the last month or so, and we've also got some incredible endorsements from various organisations, including pro-Palestine rank-and-file union groups and the like. Yeah, so it's happening tomorrow at 836 Mountain Highway in Bayswater, which is where Rosebank is located. They have removed all their signage since sort of the start of the genocide after a couple of protests there exposed who they were and what they were doing. So clearly they're a little bit embarrassed about being associated with the genocide. So they're attempting to go clandestine. So we want to shine a light on that and make sure everyone knows who they are and where they are. But we're kicking off from 2 o'clock tomorrow, and it's a short walk from Bayswater Station on the Belgrave line. So we'd love to see as many people get out there as possible. And the reason it's happening tomorrow is that it's coinciding with the big closed Pine Gap sacred land back conversions. So we're hoping by having it tomorrow to show solidarity with all of our comrades up there on Mapaitwa country near Alice Springs, and to help draw a connection and attention to the connection, I should say, between these two sites, you know. So for those who aren't aware, I'm sure most of your listeners know that Pine Gap is this extremely secretive signals intelligence site that's been run via partnership between the CIA or US intelligence more broadly and the Australian government. And they're very opaque about what goes on there. But what we do know is that they gather targeting data for US and allied drone and missile strike all around the world, but particularly the likes of Gaza and Lebanon, Iran, Yemen, Iraq. These areas, they wouldn't be able to carry out these, you know, these genocidal campaigns in this area without the crucial work that goes on at Pine Gap. And so we want to draw a connection between what happens at Pine Gap, the protests happening there, and what's happening here in our local area, in that they're both key sites of the war machine.
Thanks, Ben. Ben was our previous interviewee. So you have mentioned the F-35 fighter jet. Is there more that you can tell us about that jet?
And also, how is the Australian government involved in this as well?
Yeah, for sure. So the F-35 fighter jet, it's owned by Lockheed Martin. And this is a United States weapons manufacturer, but they rely on this global program of partners all around the world, allied countries, being involved in manufacturing the specific parts of this jet. And they have various, you know, sort of storage locations, hubs for parts to come in and for assembly and that kind of thing. For instance, in the Netherlands, there's a key supply hub there, I believe, that we've seen some protests crop up around. In Australia, so Australia is a really key partner to this program. We've got about 70 small to medium enterprises all over the country. There's somewhere around 30 in NAR Melbourne alone, or around NAR Melbourne alone. So this area in particular is it's quite highly concentrated. And they're currently up to their fifth generation of this fighter jet. In Australia, it's called the F-35A Lightning II, and we've got about 70-odd of these jets within our sort of arsenal at our disposal, our government's disposal. Israel has about 100 at this point. And what's notable about this latest model is that it also has the capability to carry nuclear warheads. So that's quite a new development as well that we all should be extremely concerned about, especially when it's being handled by rogue states such as the United States and Israel. On to how, like, the Australian government's involved in this program. So these businesses wouldn't be able to be a part of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program without significant support from the Australian government. That's both, you know, through diplomatic ties to the US and its allies, trade partnerships, these kinds of things, but also public money. So there's a massive amount of public grants that have been basically given to these different organisations to ensure they maintain their part in the F-35 supply chain. So, for instance, you may be aware of the National Reconstruction Fund Corporation. So this is a much bigger fund that's targeting several different sectors, but quite a large part of it's going towards the F-35 supply chain and sort of broader defence capability. $150 million of this is going to ASDAM, which is that broader group of corporations that Rosebank's a part of. So $150 million of our public money is going to that corporation. On top of that, we have a grant called the JSF Joint Strike Fighter Sustainment Grant, and we've seen $78 million go to these different companies. And of that $78 million, $30.2 million, so the lion's share, has gone to Rosebank Engineering here in Bayswater. And much of this has been given to these companies since October 7th, 2023. So in the midst of this genocide, as it's becoming clearer that Australia and the Australian economy is, you know, increasingly tied up with this genocide. On top of that, the Australian National Audit Office has found that in total we spent about $12.6 billion on this program, and most of that expenditure is flowing to US government contracts. So this is just sort of, the material side of it. On top of that, we're seeing the government, like, constantly obfuscating the depth of their complicity. So they constantly try to downplay how involved we are and how, responsible the government is and how involved our economic system is with what's going on and with the broader, militarist direction that our economy is going in. And so I think we should all be really opposed to that. And Rosebank's a really localised example of this much deeper issue of how entrenched our defence sector is becoming in our economy and our sort of future economic growth and that kind of thing. And so we should all be opposed to that way, of developing economically, being further and further entrenched in this US war machine.
Well, thanks for that, Jai. We'll go and finish off with the last question. Could you give us the details of the protest and, any kind of final comments and how people can help build this protest tomorrow?
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely everyone should come out. It's tomorrow at 2 p.m. in Bayswater at 836 Mountain Highway. Really easy to get to from Bayswater Station, just a short walk. And it's quite accessible as well. It's all flat, plenty of pavement. So anyone that needs mobility aids are able to access the area quite easily. And in terms of anything else I'd like to add, I just wanted to say, everyone should do their best to come out and support these sort of, these actions that are further out than our typical Palestine actions that happen in the inner city. We should definitely be trying to support movements on the fringes and their growth, in bringing more people in to the Palestine movement. And we should also remember that even though there's so-called ceasefire in Gaza, since that's come into place, we've seen over 1,000 Gazans killed. We've seen, even over the last few days, an escalation of bombing in Gaza with barely a peep from, the established media. And so I think we need to be putting our representatives on notice out here and highlighting that this genocide is still going. And, I think we can only build from here. So,
thanks
for having me.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, the point you made about supporting actions that are happening out of the CBD. It just makes it easier for people who perhaps can't make it into the city centre to still be involved in this campaign. And Jacob and I will see you tomorrow.
See you there. Thanks, comrades.
Yep, bye.
Thanks, Ty. Okay.
Yeah. All that money, that just blows my mind, which could be spent on the NDIS instead of cutting it to such a vulnerable group.
And yeah, and also I think the Albanese government's dishonesty around their complicity in all this is quite outrageous in a lot of ways. I mean, I think it's quite funny because it's like the kind of Australian government approach is like, I mean, I remember I think Julian Burnside made this sort of comparison, saying that Australia has nothing to do with the production of burgers in McDonald's because we only sell the patties or we only sell the lettuce. So we don't have anything to do with the McDonald's burgers. That's completely different. Because, yeah, really, all these sort of parts, they all have to go somewhere at some point. You can have a situation where Australia is selling these F-35 parts. They go to the US. Then those parts are then used to build the jets in the US, and then the jets then get sent to Israel. Like,
yeah, and they murder.
And then they murder people. So at the end of the day, you know, the parts go to a war machine that kills people.
Yeah.
I thought we could possibly play a quick song, but I was going to play Patti Smith's People Have the Power.
Yeah, let's do that. Sounds good.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters, on behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people, who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
Good morning. You are listening to Green Left on 3CR Radio at 8:55 a.m. on your dial. And that was Patti Smith, who I think most people will probably remember as an American singer, songwriter, poet, and author. But she was also, or she is also, politically active. She's performed at AIDS benefit concerts. She supported Ralph Nader for the US Green Party. She opposed the war in Iraq and supported boycotts of performing in Israel. She's also written songs about the IDF bombing Lebanese villages. And just more recently, she's also opposed the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that was her singing People Have the Power.
All right, so we're very happy to be joined today by our final interview for the program this week. We are joined by Deepak Joshi, who is a regular writer and founder of NIRI Affairs, a news publication covering news from an Indian diaspora perspective, and he's also part of Hindus for Human Rights. So good morning, Deepak.
Morning, Jacob.
Good morning, Thank Deepak.
Morning, Mary. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so to start off, so we have Deepak on to talk a bit about Narendra Modi's recent visit to Australia. So Narendra Modi recently visited Australia from July 8th to the 10th. And of course, the purpose of this trip has obviously been to foster Australian-Indian relations. You know, Australia and India having a bit of a special kind of relationship. And can you give us a bit of an overview about the significance of this trip?
Sure. Thank you. Australia-India, it's a very multi-layered relationship. Indians come to Australia mainly as skilled migrants or international migrants. They remain deeply connected with their mother country. There's been a big expansion of Indian diaspora here, and culturally, through films, through families, through friends, they're very deeply connected. And any person who's popular in India and they visit, whether they are film stars or sporting teams, you've seen what happens when the Indian cricket team tours Australia, or if it's the politicians like PM Modi, they're all received with a lot of enthusiasm. And Modi's visit matters on multiple levels. Indians are now the largest overseas-born group in Australia, and there's a lot of talk about the two countries sharing genuine democratic values, although we need to talk, you know, ask more serious questions what that means in practice. But let's be clear about what Australia also has at stake or has on the table. It's not a purely sentimental relationship. Australia sees India as a massive market for its resources, including gas and now uranium. Its educational sector agriculture, dairy, even sport. There's talk of the AFL teams playing there again, and Aussie rules football being promoted in India. The Indian Premier League Cricket League in India has a very significant presence of Australian players, coaching staff and supporter staff. So there are real economic interests that are driving the warmth that you see in all these public events. And there's nothing wrong with it, but it creates a risk when commercial interests dominate. Difficult questions don't get asked, and some of these deals could easily derail if they benefit only a handful of oligarchs on both sides rather than serving public good. And India's lack of governmental accountability and transparency, and we've seen there's been a lot of talk about PM Modi not giving any press conferences or any interviews to the free press. And that means that Australian businesses and governments need to go with their eyes open. So there are real questions that need to be asked. You know, why is the expansion of Indian oligarchs into Australia's resources not being scrutinized? What are the ecological costs of development that is happening with all these deals that they need to be on the table? So I think there needs to be honesty in that arrangement, including discussion on human rights, press freedom and democratic integrity. And that is the standard I think we should hold both the governments to.
Yeah.
So Deepak, tell us about why left-wing activists are opposed to Modi's visits, particularly around the human rights record and the treatment of oppressed minorities within India.
The concern falls broadly into two areas. The first is economy, the baseline development. And the picture is quite troubling there. India's human development and infrastructure indicators have not moved at the pace that economic headline numbers suggest. And some of those headline numbers are being increasingly disputed. Corruption remains systemic, and of course one of the most visible examples recently has been the nationwide agitation over a collapsed examination system where students across the country are protesting widespread fraud in national competitive exams because there's a whole generation that feels cheated and is losing faith in institutions that are meant to give them a future. The second area, of course, is freedoms, democratic freedoms, and there the data is quite unambiguous. India ranks 157 out of 180 countries in the World Press Freedom Index. The U.S. Freedom House classifies India as only partially free. Vidim, which is a Swedish democracy monitor, categorizes India as an electoral autocracy. The U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom has repeatedly rated India as a country of particular concern. These are not political opinions. These are research findings by some of the most reputed institutions around the world. And there is widespread crackdown on dissent, on protest. People like Omar Khalid and Sharjeel Imam and Sanjeev Bhatt, they are in prison. Their trials are not happening. Journalists, civil society activists, they face intimidation, arrest. The other, of course, the country is going backward on so many fronts. I mean, the state wants to monitor relationships between consenting adults when they belong to different religions. And of course, for the diaspora, there is another dimension that impacts us, which is transnational repression. People are genuinely afraid to speak up. If you criticize the Indian government publicly, you risk your Indian visa being cancelled or your family being targeted. And that is very chilling, and that is real, and that is deliberate, and it deserves to be named and questioned quite plainly. So, broadly, these are the issues that are concerned, when you talk about activists.
Yeah, so thanks for that overview, Deepak. The kind of next thing I just want to ask you is just going back to the protests. I mean, the other contradiction is that Modi's visit was also met from protests from the racist, white supremacist far right in Australia. And I guess one of the things we can't forget about, though, is I've seen it on Facebook commentary. There is this disgusting current of kind of anti-Indian racism, specifically targeting Indians because they're brown-skinned, etc., by white supremacists. So what can you tell us about what this says about anti-Indian racism? And, of course, there's also a contradiction of the far right organising a protest against Modi, given what the BJP project actually represents.
Yes, yes. And I think we need to hold two very separate things in mind here because conflating them can cause harm and confusion. Anti-Indian racism is real and it's growing and it has absolutely nothing to do with Modi's policies. When far-right groups, combine Go Back Modi with Go Back Indians, they are actually being just opportunistic, using Modi's visit to express their own, amplify their own racist agenda. That distinction must be maintained clearly, because they are not concerned about human rights in India or Modi's policies or corruption. And we've seen this the tactic before. You know, the same way any criticism of, for example, Israel gets labeled as anti-Semitism, there is a fear that voices by extremist Hindu groups and Hindu nationalist groups within the diaspora may attempt to frame any criticism of Modi as anti-Indian racism or Indophobia or even Hindophobia. And I think Australian media and political leadership and civil society should not allow that conflation to happen. But there is a profound irony that must be named, and that some of the loudest supporters of Modi's exclusionary politics that target minorities as intruders, Muslims as Christians, as non-indigenous, and that defines belonging by religion and ethnicity, they themselves find themselves a target of precisely the same politics here. They want India to be a majoritarian Hindu nation, but they would want Australia to be a cohesive, secular, multicultural nation, and that contradiction should not go unexamined. And we should also be honest about who funds this far-right politics. One Nation and similar movements around the world, whether it's UK or US, are not working class. They are backed by corporate interests that benefit from directing public anger away from policies that would genuinely serve the working class people and serve the planet. So when Gina Reinhardt donates millions to One Nation, that is not for better politics. That is basically serving her own interest. And I believe communities, especially as migrant community, I think our interests lie in solidarity with other visible struggles for justice, with refugees, with asylum seekers, with First Nations people, with anyone that politics of exclusion targets, and not in closing the door behind us or pulling the ladder.
All right, so thanks for the feedback. Just the one last question I want to ask, and that's going back to this trade issue. So I want to hear a bit more detail about this exporting of uranium. Basically, the Australian government has committed to export uranium to India. But also, I guess, if you have any comments on this increasing military relationship between Australia and India, because actually something that's come out of the trip is the defence ministers of both countries have committed to having some kind of meeting, and really much discussion around military cooperation is very much on the cards. And of course, I don't think you can disconnect this from the uranium deal, because uranium is not really just about energy. It is also about weapons. And a lot of investment in uranium and nuclear energy has always corresponded with investment in military. So yeah, just want to hear some of your comments on some of the issues there.
Your question about use of or the fear of use of Australian uranium for weapons, I think there would be enough safeguards in place. One would assume there is provision for International Atomic Energy Commission inspection to ensure that it goes to the right place and is used for the right purpose. But talking about India's need for uranium, India has a very ambitious target of adding 100 gigawatts of nuclear capacity by 2047 to fund its growing expansion and energy demand. And one could argue that India has every right to develop a peaceful nuclear energy and with the right non-proliferation framework built around them, because I think the developed world has done that for years, and I think they tend to put disproportionate pressure on developing economies when it comes to use of fossil fuel and nuclear energy to fuel their growth. So that asymmetry is worth acknowledging. But acknowledging India's sovereign right to nuclear energy is separate from asking whether this particular deal is structured responsibly. Australia is positioning itself at the top of a very long and big supply chain of that scale, 100 gigawatts. Gigawatts of production, and that comes with questions that I don't think have been adequately answered. Will Australia hold responsibility to ensure that uranium is used to the same community and environmental standards that we apply here? And then there's the ecological dimension anyway, regardless of the destination. Extraction of uranium or any extraction comes at a cost. Uranium mining affects land, water, and communities at the source as well as at the destination. So the question we need to press is whether the deal genuinely serves the people of both countries or the corporate interests. I think that deserves far more scrutiny than what has been made public by the government or the media so far.
All right, thanks for that, Deepak. We're running a bit out of time now, but if you have any final comments you'd like to add, feel free to finish on anything you'd like to add.
Okay, I mean, all I say is that, you know, the ugliness of politics we are seeing around the world, in India, Australia, is the expression of democracy. It's, you know, democracy relieving what lies underneath the working class people, failed by policies and establishment parties for decades. But what we are seeing is, you know, genuine counter movements, but, you know, from poets, from influencers, from meme makers. In India, there is this, you may have heard of the Cockroach Janata Party protest movement against the examination system, and they are demanding the resignation of the education minister. There is Gen Z on the streets of Dhaka. These things are connected. And I think our job in media, in advocacy, in civil society is to keep these movements in the news, you know, in public consciousness, keep asking questions that nobody will ask. This politics of exclusion is not inevitable. You know, the right has worked on it for decades. The RSS in India, you know, took 100 years. They kept working on it, you know, through their shakhas, through their network, through their cultural activities. The far right does it through many other ways, you know, through think tanks. One Nation has been around for decades. They work hard at it. The alternatives have to be built deliberately, and they have to be built. We need to stop feeling entitled and get down to some serious hard work.
And we need to stop there, Deepak, because we are running out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on our program, Deepak.
Thanks.
So Deepak is active in a lot of areas, and one of them is Menzies for Palestine as well. And he's a former Greens candidate.
All right. Well, thank you very much, listeners. And yeah, I'd like to thank all our guests for being on this week. You know, onward to the struggle for a better world. And yeah, if you support the work that Green Left does, consider becoming a financial supporter. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Kant. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back, reds underneath your beds and that crap.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.